Welcome to the SGO podcast on immunotherapy. My name is Karen Shi, and I'm a gynecologic oncologist and assistant professor at Northwell Health Hofstra Medical School in Long Island, New York. This is part three of our ongoing series on immunotherapy toxicity. In today's session, we'll be discussing common controversies in immunotherapy and also touching on broader clinical questions facing immunotherapy. I'm again joined by two fabulous guests, Dr. Erin Zaholsky and Dr. Sarah Hayward. Welcome, ladies.
Glad to be here again. My name is Sarah Hayward. I am a clinical pharmacy specialist in gynecologic oncology at the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center at Stevenson Cancer Center in Oklahoma City.
Hi, everyone. Excited for our last installment here. My name is Erin Zaholsky. I'm an assistant professor at VCU School of Pharmacy in Richmond, Virginia, where I am a clinical pharmacist in our GYN oncology clinic here.
Thanks so much, guys, for joining us today for our discussion. So as you recall, in part one of this series, we discussed the basics of immune-related adverse events. In part two, we had a very informative session on common controversies in immunotherapy. Today, we'll be touching on additional controversies, as well as broader clinical questions facing immunotherapy. So first thing we wanted to discuss are, what are optimal dosing strategies in immune checkpoint inhibitors on the U.S. market?
That is a great question and a bit all over the place. And we don't always know the answer to that. But when we first started looking at immune checkpoint inhibitors, they were all weight-based dosing. And then over time, some of them have received approval for flat dosing. We'll talk about that more here in just a little bit. What I want to focus on specifically is those medications that we still do weight-based dosing in, specifically nivolumab and ipilimumab. So depending on the disease site and depending on staging, we can see what's referred to as NIVO-1-IPI-3 or NIVO-1-IPI-3. So whether we give 1 milligram per kilogram of NIVO or 1 milligram per kilogram of ipilimumab in combination with 3 milligrams per kilogram of the alternate agent. You see this combination in assorted disease sites. Dosing varies with the exception of metastatic melanoma and hepatocellular. We do see that higher dose of ipilimumab, but generally in the other settings, renal, colorectal, non-small cell, and even some data in cervical cancer, generally we're going to see that nivolumab 3 and ipilimumab 1 milligram per kilogram. That's a bit of a tongue twister. I'm going to call it IPI moving forward. So the reason being is we generally see increased toxicity with increased doses of IPI. More often than not, when you see these given together, we give the combination of IPI-NIVO for a total of 4 doses, and then we transition to nivolumab maintenance alone. There have even been studies looking at 3 milligrams per kilogram of both of these medications together, but the toxicities were prohibitive in moving that particular dosing forward. When we look at the clinical trial data, there are a lot of variances of immune-related adverse events versus efficacy. Because we see variances in these doses with ipilimumab and nivolumab, it's really important to refer back to the actual clinical trial data and what is approved per guidelines. We even see indications for ipilimumab to be given every 6 weeks at very low doses of that 1 milligram per kilogram. When we look at the cervical data, since we are gynoncs and that's what we talk about, we look at CheckMate 358. This was single agent nivolumab versus the combination of 3 versus 1 nivolumab ipi or 1 versus 3. Nivolumab IPI. And overall, what we saw was an increased overall response rate with the increasing dosage of IPI. So something to think about. Overall, the optimal combination is not conclusive. It varies per disease site, it varies per stage. So we'll continue to see what the data reveals.
Can you talk about the story of flat dosing in immunotherapy? And should this apply to extremes of body weight?
Another great question about dosing. My opinion is that flat dosing should probably apply to patients at extremes of body weight. But the story is interesting. As Sarah mentioned, the immune checkpoint inhibitors were initially dosed based on body weight, so milligrams per kilogram. But as population pharmacokinetic data accumulated, fixed dose regimens or flat dosing for some agents were found to improve convenience while preserving the efficacy of the immunotherapy. So for example, there was an equivalency study for pembrolizumab in lung cancer showing that 2 milligrams per kilogram and 10 milligrams per kilogram were equally effective. So that's a really big difference in mg per kg dosing with equal efficacy. This finding led to a change in dosing policy by Merck. Subsequent trials with pembrolizumab used that fixed dose of 200 milligrams every 3 weeks for all patients, regardless of their weight. Of course, we have more recently an FDA approval of high-dose extended interval dosing regimens. For example, nivolumab 480 milligrams every 4 weeks and pembrolizumab 400 milligrams every 6 weeks. And these, like I said, were all added to approved adult indications based on simulations that were validated in clinical trials. I say all this and communicate the story because one could theorize that flat dosing would lead to an underdosing of our overweight and obese patients on immunotherapy. But in order to go with my opinion here that probably it's okay, we lean back on our pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamic knowledge as pharmacists. So monoclonal antibodies typically distribute in the plasma, in the blood, and then the extracellular fluids only. So they're not really going out into the fat, into the muscle. So our increases in weight don't really affect the distribution of immunotherapy like they would with other drugs with different properties. So I'm going to say that, yes, we can probably lean on our flat dosing where it's approved.
That's really interesting, Erin. Something else that begs a question here, I think, is you mentioned in lung cancer, equivalency was shown with 2 milligrams per kilogram and 10 milligrams per kilogram. So I would ask the question, do we need the high doses that we use? You know, when we think about phase one dose escalation, we're looking at the maximum tolerated dose, not necessarily the minimum efficacious dose. I know that sounds odd wording, but are we overdosing now, maybe? Thoughts?
I think that's a great point, especially at our for our patients at the other extremes of body weight, so our patients who are underweight. And we also need to remember how expensive immunotherapy is. So if we could reduce the dose in these situations, we could be maybe saving toxicity. We don't know the answer to that question, but certainly saving money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, toxicity, who knows? But definitely a savings to the healthcare system at large.
To be continued on that, I think.
Fair.
What about response to immunotherapy? Are adverse events correlated with the response?
Overall, my answer to this question is yes, perhaps, with some caveats. So there are three studies that I'll point out here, two of them being systematic reviews and meta-analyses, and one being a multi-center cohort study. So first, we'll talk about what these systematic reviews and meta-analyses show. So the first was published by Zhang and colleagues in the Journal for Immunotherapy and Cancer in 2019. And they evaluated 48 clinical trials for patients on immunotherapy, which included 8,000 patients with 8 different cancer types. And their overall conclusion was that a positive correlation with nivolumab was seen between objective response rate and the incidence rate of skin, GI, and endocrine immune-related adverse events. They did not find the same association with hepatic, pulmonary, and renal immune-related adverse events in this study. The second systematic review was by Husseini and colleagues, published in Cancer Treatment Reviews in 2021, and they included 51 studies, including patients with a range of solid tumors. Their conclusion was that patients with immune-related adverse events had improved treatment efficacy, irrespective of disease site, type of immune checkpoint inhibitor, and immune-related adverse events. However, I think an important finding here is that among patients who experience severe immune-related adverse events, in other words, grade 3 or 4 toxicities, there was an increased response to immunotherapy, but worse overall survival. Finally, this multi-center cohort study of over 600 patients by Shankar and colleagues in JAMA Oncology was published in the last few years as well. And so this was a cohort study, as I mentioned, of patients with non-small cell lung cancer treated with a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. And they found that if a patient experienced multi-system immune-related adverse events, this was associated with improved survival in this non-small cell lung cancer treatment setting. And they also found that there was an incremental improvement between experiencing one immune-related adverse event and multiple. So this also gives us some significant evidence that there is an association there.
I think those are some really good points to make. And as we continue to use immune checkpoint inhibitors, that will be really interesting to show what the data shows over time. You know, like we know with our EGFR inhibitors, that saying that rash is indicative of a response. It's really great information.
Let's talk about the sequence of immunotherapy. Is there an optimal sequence?
That answer is unknown at this time. I think when we talk about sequencing of immunotherapy, there's a couple different ways we can interpret that word sequencing. It could involve the order of administration of immune checkpoint inhibitors with the same day chemotherapy they're prescribed with. It could involve sequencing with giving immune checkpoint inhibitors before chemotherapy, after chemotherapy. And we could also discuss sequencing in the realm of, is it better to give immune checkpoint inhibitors earlier on in therapy or earlier on in the disease in a frontline setting versus later with recurrence or in the metastatic setting? And there's a lot of unanswered questions here. I actually don't think I have a definitive answer for any of these. So when we look at these variations on sequencing, first let's discuss order of administration with chemo that day. When we discuss order of administration with pembrolizumab and same-day chemotherapy, does it matter? We know that it matters when we discuss certain chemotherapy. For instance, when we discuss giving cisplatin and paclitaxel, there's a specific order to help reduce incidence of myelosuppression. But does that matter with immune checkpoint inhibitors? The package insert, for example, with pembrolizumab states that you should give the pembro before you give the chemo. When you look at indications for IPI and NEVO, it states that the NEVO should be given before the IPI. But why? The short answer is that's how it was done in the clinical trials. There's a really great article from the Journal of Hematology Oncology Pharmacy. There's two in the series. There's one done in 2011. This is Mancini and Modlin that looked at the importance of sequencing for chemotherapy. They then did an update in 2018 to include new chemotherapies that had been approved, monoclonal antibodies, and a few immune checkpoint inhibitors that we had on the market at the time. They did reach out to the manufacturers specifically in regards to pembrolizumab and, you know, why do we need to give it before chemotherapy? And the response that they received really was, that's what we did in clinical trials. So when in doubt, we know what they did in the clinical trial, so we can take that information and use it. What about sequencing immune checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy? Again, the answer is unknown, and it varies depending on disease site. As we look at clinical trial data, we'll see that sometimes giving one first versus the other or jointly can have an increase in efficacy or no change in efficacy or changes in toxicities. There's an article I came across trying to find the answer to this called Chemoimmunotherapy, a New Trend in Cancer Treatment, not really a new trend, but there's a lot of back and forth in this article regarding the relationship between chemo and immune checkpoint inhibitors and how each one individually affects the other, how each one can affect the individual tumor microenvironment in both positive and negative ways. So sequencing before or after chemo or with chemo, go back to your clinical trial data. And then when we look at using immune checkpoint inhibitors earlier versus later in therapy, we're going to see that current clinical trials would indicate that immune checkpoints in the upfront setting generally leads to better outcomes than chemotherapy alone. Right, we saw this with the Ruby GY018, where we had improved outcomes with patients when we added that immunotherapy up front. But this is not always the case. When we look at small cell lung cancer, when we tried to add ipilimumab to a platinum doublet, there really was no change in efficacy, and we had additional toxicity. So again, very dependent on the disease site and the setting. Aaron, what are your thoughts on the topic or any of these topics?
Generally, I agree with these comments, Sarah. I think there's a lot of interest in the GYN oncology world now about sequencing as far as is it better to do immunotherapy up front versus with a second or third line regimen? And I think we need more data to answer this question, particularly if we're giving immunotherapy up front with our platinum doublet in advanced endometrial cancer, what happens to the outcomes when the patient progresses. Firstly, what do we do next? Do we give an immunotherapy
Yeah.
screening regimen? And what are those patients' outcomes compared to patients who have not had earlier immunotherapy?
Exactly. And we just don't have that information at present. We're not at the point, I think, in especially in the gyn-onc setting, where we know that we can do immune checkpoint inhibitor after already having received an immune checkpoint inhibitor. Yeah, to be determined.
Many questions to be still explored. Thanks so much for joining us today for our discussion. In this three-part series, we have discussed a lot of information as related to immunotherapy. There is definitely an increased use of immunotherapy in gynecologic oncology, and applying all the information that we've provided in this three-part series to clinical practice is so relevant. There are still so many questions that need to be answered and explored as immunotherapy continues to evolve in gynecologic oncology. So thank you so much, Dr. Zaholsky and Dr. Hayward, for joining me for this podcast.
Thank you for having us.
The information presented is that of the contributing faculty and presenters and does not necessarily represent the views of the Society of Gynecologic Oncology or any named company or organization providing financial support. Specific therapies discussed may not be approved and/or specified for use as indicated by the faculty or presenters. If you like what you heard today, please let us know by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and hitting the follow button wherever you're listening. If you have suggestions for future SGO On the Go podcasts, please email us at education@sgo.org.